Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 40 years ago, Robert Pirsig took off on a motorbike ride with his son and a couple of friends and planned a book on his thoughts along the way. It was called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Legions of readers say the book changed their lives. Now a new Pirsig pilgrim has retraced the journey. This hour on Point, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, the book, the philosophy, the journey, 40 years on. You can join the conversation. Did you read it way back then, 10 years ago, yesterday? Did it change your life? And what is the appeal of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance? What's the message you took away? Joining me now from Denver is Pirsig pilgrim Mark Richardson. He's a writer at the Toronto Star and author of the new book, Zen and Now, on the trail of Robert Pirsig and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Mark Richardson, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, hello, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here. It's pouring rain outside in Denver, so I'm happy to be inside for a while.
All right. Safe and dry for the moment. Also joining us from Denver, it turns out, is Ron DeSanto, professor of philosophy at Regis University. He's co-author with Father Thomas Steele of a study of Pirsig's philosophy called Guidebook to Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Ron DeSanto, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hello, Tom. Glad to be here.
We're going to go to this journey. But, Ron, I wish you'd just put it in, let's start with a nutshell and we'll get bigger. But in a nutshell, what was Robert Pirsig trying to convey in this book that has sold so many millions of copies and continues selling so many years after the journey that Mark Richardson retraced?
Well, let me see if I can put it in a nutshell. I think he was saying that if we can truly get in touch with quality, we can overcome some of the dichotomies of our modern age, including the non-coalescence of feeling and knowing. The distinction between what he called the classic and the romantic modes, that is to say a rational technical approach to reality as opposed to one that more involves feeling and aesthetics, subject-object dualism. He's basically dealing with a cultural malaise that involves all of these dichotomies, and I think he's basically saying that once we get in touch with quality and see what that's about, we can be on our way to overcoming those dichotomies and that malaise.
The non-coalescence of feeling and knowing in modern life, what exactly does that mean?
Well, people tend to approach life either in a fundamentally detached knowing mode, so they get the scientific personality, or a more emotional feeling mode, so they get the non-scientific mentality. And often these are accompanied by a pro-technological versus an anti-technological approach to life. As Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance illustrated, there are people who want to get away from it all. They want to get away from all the technology and all that kind of stuff. And John sort of epitomizes that in that book. And the narrator in that book is trying to epitomize the way of being into technology. But he's trying to say that we can do it in such a way that we bring the knowing and the feeling together. We don't have to be a scientist on the one hand or a dropout on the other.
Mark Richardson, it's often been said in the years since that Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance wasn't really about Zen and wasn't really about motorcycles and wasn't really about maintenance. And yet, Pirsig wrapped it intimately around this journey that you've recreated. I want to talk about his own background. It's really fascinating. But let's just take on the journey itself first. He rode from where to where, with whom, in what circumstances, when before the book?
It was back in 1968, and he rode on his old bike, which was only a little Honda, in fact, a 305cc Honda Superhawk. He rode it from his home in St. Paul, Minnesota, all the way through to San Francisco. It took him a couple of weeks. He stopped off for a while halfway in Bozeman, Montana, where he met up with some friends. And for the first half of the journey, he rode with his friends, the Sutherlands, John and Sylvia Sutherland. They left in Bozeman. Pirsig went off and climbed a mountain, which is very figurative in the book, climbed a mountain near Bozeman with his son, Chris, and then they set off on their own for the final half of the journey, through to San Francisco.
his son Chris, who on this journey was stuffed in back of him on the motorcycle, and with a fraught relationship between father and son playing out along these many miles.
Well, that's right. Chris was 11 years old, and as comes through in Persig's book, Chris was just starting to show signs of mental illness. And this is especially touching because Persig, as he makes clear in his own book, had been through mental illness, struggled with mental illness in the most graphic way. He had actually been, he was a schizophrenic and had been subjected to shock therapy several years previously. And in fact, the structure of his book is that there are two characters who take Persig's place. Mm. The book is written by Robert Persig, but the person who is doing the narration is really not Robert Persig, and this is why it gets a little complicated for
a
lot of
people. He says he took liberties. Don't take this as actual fact. He's taking liberties with the narrative.
He says it right off the top, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And he says right off the top that this really isn't very much about Zen, or it isn't really very much about motorcycles. But he speaks as two different people mm-hmm. in the book. It comes through as a struggle between his alter ego, who he calls Phaedrus, which is basically supposed to be Persig before the shock treatment, whose memory was then wiped out, according to the book, and then the narrator, who is the person after shock treatment. And as I say, it gets a little complicated for the casual reader because they can't always tell who's who.
Ron, we'll hear what drew Mark Richardson into this. I mean, he's an automotive and motorcycle writer. He comes from that angle, maybe. You're our philosopher. Millions have dived into this book in the years since it came out in 1974, after the journey in 1968. What's your sense of what has attracted so many to this book? Why it became the kind of iconic, you know, seeker's book for so many in these decades, Ron?
Well, I think that it's just an extremely rich book, and I think people get into it for different reasons and stay with it for different reasons. What I found, and I've been teaching philosophy for 36 years, and I just found that students would pick up that book, and it would kind of turn them on, and they would actually get into philosophy through that book. As the book points out, it gets into the higher mountains of the mind, and I found that it was a good way to introduce students to philosophy, just in terms of what I'm doing. But I also found, talking with people outside of academia, that it was a book that really changed people's lives. Now, why? I think it's different in different cases, but I think one of the reasons is because it's dealing very squarely with the question of the technological age, and a lot of people just find it too much. They feel like something terrible has been lost. They're trying to retrieve that something, and yet there's no escaping it. The technological age is with us. Things are very complicated. So how are we going to find some kind of peace of mind in the midst of the technological hubbub, if you will?
Here is an excerpt from Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, read by actor Michael Kramer. Persig explains here why traveling on a motorbike isn't just exhilarating for him. It's also a way to get in closer touch with the reality around.
In a car, you're always in a compartment, and because you're used to it, you don't realize that through that car window, everything you see is just more TV. You're a passive observer, and it is all moving by you, boringly, in a frame. On a cycle, the frame is gone. That concrete whizzing by 5 inches below your foot is the real thing, so blurred you can't focus on it, yet you can put your foot down and touch it any time.
Mark Richardson, you didn't set out here as a philosopher, though in some ways we're all forced to grapple with philosophy as we make our way through life. You set out as going on 40-something, middle-aged, automotive and motorcycle writer for a newspaper. Was this just a way to have a nice summer trip, or were you looking for something else, something deeper?
Well, hey, I don't know that 41 years old is middle age just yet. Isn't 50 the new middle age?
Okay, have it your way.
I'm clinging to it as best I can.
Sounded like midlife crisis to me.
Well, you know, I realized after I got back that, yeah, sure, it was a midlife crisis. I got to admit to that. I have a wife, two young sons, and my life was not the same as it was 20 years previously when I was a happy-go-lucky bachelor. And in fact, I'd taken off on my motorcycle and traveled around America. I spent more than a year just being a bum around America, just having a look at it. And You know, I read Zen and the Art. I'd read it, or I'd tried to read it before as a young man, and again as a student of philosophy that I wasn't much good at. But I never really finished the book until the third time through, when I was, literally, I had the time to do so. I was lying in a hammock beside a lake. And I finished it, and I thought, on the one side, I thought, you know, that's a darn good road trip. I'd love to be able to make a trip like that on my motorcycle and just see if I'm the same guy as I used to be 20 years ago. But inside of me, there was also the nagging midlife crisis part that was thinking that, you know, maybe the grass is greener on the other side. And since so much came through for Robert Persig, and so much has come together for the various pilgrims who followed this trip, I thought, well, if I follow this trip myself, rather than branching off or anything else, perhaps some of it will rub off on me, and I'll come back a better person. But I just went into it with an open mind to see what would happen. And as I say, when I started it, it was just supposed to be a road trip.
Mm.
And when I wrote my book originally, it was just supposed to be a road trip. I had very little interest in telling the story of Robert Persig. And I didn't know the story of Robert Persig, to be honest. None of it was out there. But I also sort of, as I wrote the book, I realized that I was writing a lot more about my own relationship, both with my family and with myself, trying to reconcile the differences of the age that Persig gets into.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Zen and the art of motorcycle maintenance 40 years after it all began, with a new biker, a new voyager and voyage who has followed the trail. Mark Richardson is with us. He joins us from Denver, Colorado. His new book is Zen and Now. He followed the trail that Robert Persig set out on 17 days from Minneapolis-St. Paul to San Francisco in 1968. Came out in 1974 in a book that has sold millions of copies since and continues to sell a lot. Ron DeSanto is with us as well, knows that book intimately, co-authored the guidebook to Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Let's hear just a little bit more from the book. Robert Persig's travel companions, John and Sylvia Sutherland, were kind of anti-technologists on this famous journey. They were thinking the way to find happiness and wisdom was to get away from it all. Persig disagreed. He said technology used right was fine, and wisdom could be found in man-made things just as much as in nature. Here's actor Michael Kramer reading again.
I disagree with them about cycle maintenance, but not because I am out of sympathy with their feelings about technology. I just think that their flight from and hatred of technology is self-defeating. The Buddha, the Godhead, resides quite as comfortably in the circuits of a digital computer or the gears of a cycle transmission as he does at the top of a mountain or in the petals of a flower.
Actor Michael Kramer reading from the original Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. We're at 800-423-8255. Paul is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm actually calling from Brookline Booksmith in Brookline, and I talked to one of your producers, Stefan, about this long.
Oh, yes, wonderful.
Thanks.
Good to have you.
Yeah, I read this maybe 15 years ago when I was in high school, and I'm one of those people that it definitely changed the way I look at the world. I found so much in tune with what I suspected about the nature of reality that I was able to close that book and walk out the door the next day, and things actually looked different, and they made much more sense. And I actually was an anti-technology person for long after reading this book, but I have completely come to peace with it. He has so much to say in this book about the tools, the mode of discussion, and the tools we use, and the knowledge that we have inside. We already get it. It's just kind of freeing up our minds and allowing ourselves to use these tools. And I think that's where the art of the motorcycle maintenance comes into it. It's Buddhism through a state of mind. It's a very simple thing, and I'm not saying it well.
Well, no, you are, Paul. But I wanted to ask first, just so 15 years ago, so it had been out for many years before you picked it up. You became one of millions who did pick it up. Why? Was it something about, you know, it's an unusual title? It's a road trip. What brought you to it? It's brought millions of others as well. What? Why?
My mother's a librarian. And she had always, you know, kind of guided me, nudged me along with books that she felt were important. I think she was the first person who mentioned it to me. And I think Maybe I had just reached a certain frame of mind where I was ready to get out of, you know, the sort of fantasy novels I've been reading, and I wanted something a little bit more serious. I was starting to have questions. I'd been a very capable but reluctant, you know, student.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't take advice very well. I really willfully forged my own path, but nothing had really, I hadn't had any kind of role model, no leadership that I could really put any kind of trust in. And I picked this book up, and immediately I could tell that this guy's gentle, graceful, sure voice was the sort of voice that I could listen to. And when he came to in the middle of the book, and he starts talking about the idea of quality with a capital Q,
mm-hmm.
and he illustrated it with this idea of a train moving through a prairie, and the track it's following is quality, and we're all following that track. We are unable to get out of the stream of human experience because that track is finding the most simple, easy, and useful way to move through reality, and that's quality. And that made so much sense to me because I was finding my own way already. I'd been doing it for years, but, you know, often butting heads with teachers and authority figures, but I'd been doing it. I'd been finding the simplest, most truthful, easy way for myself to get through. And suddenly I read this guy talking about exactly that. I was simply following the quality path, the useful path, the good path. And now I knew it, and it made looking ahead so much more simple. And I've used that as an artist. I've used it as a father now, and I've used it as a citizen and in my job. Looking ahead and just sort of reading the landscape, taking what's useful, putting my hand to it, putting my experience to it, you find the simple and the easy path. And this book has been a kind of quiet, gentle guide in the background of my life ever since I read it.
Paul, you're testifying Zen style there, and I love it. Thank you very much for that. Mark Richardson, let me take that first to you, because that simple, easy, useful path that that Pearsig wrote about and our caller Paul describes, I have to say an awful lot of people in contemporary life do not seem to feel that they're on such a path, simple, easy, useful. Quite the contrary. The world can seem awfully cluttered and chattery and jittery.
Well, that's because we have so many distractions that can just constantly pull us off the path that we're trying to follow. And Pearsig has taken the point that, well, you've got to combine art with science, if you will, in order to find the happy medium. You don't have to dismiss art. In fact, you must not dismiss art, nor must you dismiss science. You have to find that straight track that goes through the middle, the one that suits you and fits you. And when you can do that, you can reconcile yourself with your own life.
Ron DeSanto, our caller Paul talks about it as Buddhism. Pearsig says, well, it's not really about Zen. Well, philosophically, is it a Zen posture that the book yearns toward, describes, or something else?
Well, I think, you know, the disclaimer at the front that is not much about Zen, or for that matter about motorcycles, has to be taken with a huge grain of salt.
Yes.
I think it is, but it's just not explicit, but it's coming through in various ways. You know, Zen is about awakening to the freshness of the moment. And I think quality, in Pearsig's sense, is similarly about that. I thought Paul spoke very eloquently about what quality's about the train and the track. I would simply point out that it's also the cutting edge for Pearsig, what he calls romantic quality, the cutting edge of the train. So it's the track, it's the guide, it's also that thing that's pulling us right up front. And in many ways, Zen is about that. And I don't want to launch into a long lecture about Zen, but a disciple went to a Zen master once and said, how can I become enlightened? And the Zen master says, go wash your bowl.
Simple as that,
yes. And, of course, it doesn't just end there, but that kind of opens up all kinds of things. If I could just add to something Mark was talking about, the clutter and the distractions and everything else. One of the things that Pearsig's talking about is our capacity to overcome those distractions, not simply by getting away from them, but by introducing caring. Care is a very important word, and peace of mind is a very important word in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And when we develop attitudes of caring and peace of mind, then we're able to be in the clutter without being of the clutter. And I think that's a very Zen idea, that enlightenment is found in the midst of everyday life, not necessarily or just by going aside to a monastery.
And then, as you say, there was this big philosophical question of how to bring the rational mind and romantic mind together. Here's another bit from the original where he pits his friends John and Sylvia, the romantics, against the hyper-rational Phaedrus, which is the name he used for himself, the self he had been when he was in one of his periods of insanity.
I've a vision of an angry, continuing social crisis that no one really understands the depth of, let alone has solutions to. I see people like John and Sylvia living lost and alienated from the whole rational structure of civilized life, looking for solutions outside that structure, but finding none that are really satisfactory for long. And then I've a vision of Phaedrus and his lone, isolated abstractions in the laboratory, actually concerned with the same crisis, but starting from another point, moving in the opposite direction. And what I'm trying to do here is put it all together.
Trying to put it all together, and it's quite something to put together with his own personal history, not to mention these giant philosophical questions. Joining us right now from Exeter, New Hampshire, is James Landis. He was Robert Persig's editor, the man who first accepted the manuscript for publication after it had been rejected over 100 times. He's now a novelist and writer of children's books and a friend of Robert Persig, author of Cars on Mars and 49 Other Poems for Kids on Earth and the Valley. James Landis, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, hi, Tom.
Hi. First of all, does Robert Persig ever speak publicly anymore?
Publicly, he certainly speaks. he talks to me and he talks to others, and I think I don't think he goes out and gives speeches, but I don't think he ever really wanted to go out and give speeches. So that wasn't particularly part of this book from the beginning, anyway.
Yeah, we tried to reach him, and he's not exactly easy to get close to. James Landis, what made this book jump out of that big pile to you? Why did you publish it when so many others had passed?
Well, there wasn't exactly a pile. Bob wrote a letter to my beloved late boss, a man named John Willey, in June of 1968, a very short letter. But what Bob was wise about was that instead of just writing to our company, William Morrow, he wrote to an actual person there. And John just, I don't know if John even read the letter, but he gave it to me and probably wrote on it, do something with this. And I wrote to Bob a couple of days later. But the letter said that he was writing a book about a unification of spiritual feeling and technological thought, which is obviously still relevant because you've been talking about that so far this hour. So I wrote Bob a letter, and I said, oh, I'd love to see this book. And that was the beginning of almost 4.5 years of letter writing between us before I actually saw the book. There were not 120 odd publishers before me so much as simultaneous with me. I think that he wrote the same letter to, I think, 122 of us, and over the years we dropped out. But by the time he finished the book some 4 years later, there were six of us left. And he sent it off to six of us. Now, I had no idea. I thought I was the only one there. So what really happened was that there was a full manuscript of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and six editors in New York got it. Mm-hmm. And after we read it, only one of us was left.
Were you surprised?
To make an actual bid for it.
Were you surprised by its incredible success? Did you know when you finally read the manuscript that this was publishing gold? This would be catnip for so many readers.
No, I probably was surprised at the extent of it. If I hadn't been, I probably would have paid him more money as an advance. But I mean, nobody would have predicted this. But I was extremely enthusiastic and wrote notes around the house saying, you know, we had to publish this, and then when we were going to publish it, I wrote memos about how this was likely to do, and I encountered remarkably little resistance in the house for what was a quite unusual book at the time. So my people went along with it. We didn't really have a lot of fighting over it. What surprises me is that other people didn't want to publish it. But I was, you know, as I said, I thought no one else was reading it, so I got a little scared when I heard there were other people reading it, and he said, I'll get back to you.
Right. Mark Richardson, you followed the trail, and you've looked closely at the biography of Percy, and it's in those days at least, kind of a tortured biography in no small part. But remind us how many of these ideas that he lays out in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and you recount in Zen and Now, he'd been thinking about for years. He used this trip as a latticework, as a framework to present these. When he was actually making the ride in 68, it was on his mind. How was he sewing the two together, Mark?
Well, in fact, he had pitched the book originally, or he had thought of writing the book as an essay. It came about from the original intention to write an essay for his friend, John Sutherland, just reconciling the art and the science and the various problems of the age. And then he thought that, you know, there's more than just an essay here. Perhaps there is a book. And he needed a framework on which to put this. So he had already planned to go off on what was going to be a sort of a six-week holiday with his son, Chris, on their motorcycle. They were going to go and see some friends in Bozeman and then down in Hollywood and then back again. And he realized that, well, every story needs a framework on which to pin it, and this particular motorcycle trip would make such a framework.
And off.
The wonderful part about the book, or at least for me, was the evocative descriptions of the road trip along the way and of the experiences they encountered. It was interesting because Jim Landis had told me that when he edited the book, he barely even noticed the road trip. When I read the book, I had to skim over the philosophy for the first couple of readings anyway in order to take it all in. And different people who have commented to me about his book have all told me that they've taken different things from it. And I have to admit that every time I read it, and I've read it a whole bunch of times now, I read something new into it every time.
Let's get a call from Aiken, South Carolina, and Henry. Hi, Henry. You're on the air.
Hi. Henry Gurr here, a longtime advocate of Robert Persig's book. And Tom, it's great that you featured this on this program and discussed so accurately about what the Zen and Yard Motorcycle Maintenance is about. And Dr. DeSanto and Ken Landis and Paul, they've all been telling your listeners, well, what's really in the book and what the reader may expect to get out of it, and congratulations for getting all that correct. And I wanted to say is, why is Mr. Persig's book so significant, and why is it important for people to read in our own times? And it really will change your life. We live in the technological times that people don't understand. Our society doesn't understand how it is torquing our lives and steering us away from achieving what we need to achieve in this life. And this book will help you get back on track. It's done that for me. For one of the things that pointed out to me that, well, no, it was not success, it was not hurry up and make accomplishments. What I was really moving towards in this life is inner peace of mind. And that's what people will get from this book and what they will find from the book. Now, it is quite hard to read, and you may have to pick it up three or four times to finally get going on it. But eventually, if you do really try hard enough, the book will make a breakthrough.
Henry, we appreciate your call and observation there from Aiken, South Carolina. Henry Gurr. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance 40 years after it all began with a 1968 ride and 1974 publication. Millions of copies sold now. We're talking with a new motorcyclist, at least on this path, a new voyager who has followed the trail. Mark Richardson has written Zen and Now on the Trail of Robert Persig and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, followed that same path from Minneapolis-St. Paul to San Francisco up over the Continental Divide, retraced and actually met a fair number of the people that Robert Persig had met on his trip in 1968. Ron DeSanto is with us as well. He's co-author of Guidebook to Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. James Landis is with us. He was Robert Persig's editor, the man who sort of got the letter, got the manuscript published all those years ago, and is still in touch with Robert Persig today, as Mark Richardson has been, by letter anyway, in the course of putting this book together. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance was different from a lot of other influential books of that era. It was not about tuning out or dropping out, not about political activism, but for Persig, changing the world through politics was in a way putting the cart before the horse. Here's actor Michael Kramer reading again.
I think that if we are going to reform the world and make it a better place to live in, the way to do it is not with talk about relationships of a political nature, which are inevitably dualistic, full of subjects and objects and their relationship to one another, or with programs full of things for other people to do. The place to improve the world is first in one's own heart and head and hands, and then work outward from there. Other people can talk about how to expand the destiny of mankind. I just want to talk about how to fix a motorcycle.
From Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, Zen and Just Fixing a Motorcycle. We've got just for a minute here Christopher Queen, lecturer in Buddhist Studies at Harvard University. Christopher, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Great show as always. I wanted to say that something was in the drinking water or the maybe smoke coming through the air in America at that time, because I was looking at the whole Earth catalog in 1968 and saw the BMW motorcycle that the Richardsons, the Sutherlands, drove in the book.
Oh, boy.
And I ordered one. I took off for Europe to pick it up at the factory, and my sister begged to come along.
So lucky you.
It was a family event, just as it was for Persig, and we experienced those German Beetles that strike your teeth as you're smiling through the countryside. But I wanted to also say that, you know, even though Persig is very modest about the Zen connections in his preface and says it has nothing to do with the body of factual information relating to Orthodox Zen Buddhism or even motorcycles, he's being far too modest, because his book falls in a great line of wonderful Zen and the Art of books that started coming out in 1953 with Eugene Harrigel's Zen and the Art of Archery. And then following that, we had, of course, the two great Kerouac books, On the Road and Dharma Bombs, Alan Watts' A Way of Zen, Philip Kaplow's The Three Pillars of Zen, Thomas Merton's Zen and the Birds of Appetite. And then on into the 70s, Shinryu Suzuki, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and Persig was a regular daily meditator, by the way, and was very serious about his practice. We had Peter Matheson's also great travel book where he went looking for the snow leopard in the Himalayas, also troubled, very troubled by family issues that were on his mind, having bad dreams and so forth. So Persig's book is really very much a part of that period and that era, and the just sitting or just writing or just fixing the bike is something that we all learn very profoundly from the book. And thanks so much for featuring it.
Well, just meditating through archery in the old sort of Zen Japanese style, or just fixing the bike. But let me ask you this, Christopher. Yes, there was a route that went back richly into the 50s, but there was still an exotic appeal about Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance in 1974. Sometimes I have the feeling that today a kind of Buddhist sensibility has seeped much more widely into mainstream American thinking. What do you think? You're a Buddhist studies guy.
It's very, very true. And I mean, you see kids going to the local YMC to do martial arts, and you see everybody's going to yoga. And the Asian non-dualism, the non-materialism, the sense that there is something far more to life than making money and competing has very much seeped into our culture. And I think it makes us very troubled about the world that we see around us. And hopefully it will affect our politics. That last reading was very good. Politics is a lot deeper than one party fighting against another. But I think Americans and Europeans and folks around the world are beginning to see that the personal is the political, and that the ability to simply do something well. The notion of quality, by the way, I think, since reading the book a number of times, is very much like the notion of Buddha nature in traditional, particularly East Asian Zen Buddhism, that pervades everything, but you only perceive it when you stop and breathe and take a second look or a third or fourth look.
Christopher Queen, Buddhist Studies at Harvard. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
Let me take a call from Howard in Brookline, Massachusetts. Howard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I read the book long ago. I didn't get any life-changing things out of it. I kind of expected this reconciliation or connection between, you know, the un, the emotional and the logical.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, what I see is that since 68, our society has gone the opposite direction, and people are more ruthless, more money-oriented, and less willing to incorporate their heart into things. How do you think that fits in with the premise of the book?
That is a great question. Mark Richardson, let me bring it to you, because you were back out on the same road very recently, following the path, but seeing the country as it is now, and you hear Howard's observation. It doesn't look to him like a society that's really absorbed these messages. You were thinking about the book, had read the book three times, were reading it for the third time, Mark, and you were seeing America go by. What about Howard's observation?
Well, Zen and the Art makes very personal observations and basically tells us that we have to reconcile what's in ourselves before we can go out and reconcile society. And not everybody has read Zen and the Art. After all, this is not a way to change the world. This is just a way to change your own individual space in the world. And if you can get out on a motorcycle and bare your chest to the wind and the rain and everything else and just open up your mind to what's around you and see and experience everything that you can subject yourself to on the nakedness of a cycle, especially on the road less traveled that Persig took, then, well, personally, I found that it did reconcile my own life. I can't say that I can now, write to the president and change the world for that, but I can certainly be happy with my space in it.
Again and again, you ran across people that Persig had run across. They always recognized you. They saw you coming because they were accustomed to meeting what you call, and often they called, Persig pilgrims, the many others who had followed the same trail. Introduce us to a couple of those that you met, Mark, who may have carried something from him or been interesting in their own right.
It was astonishing the number of people who were just ordinary folks who remembered the book and knew of the book. Who are not necessarily even in the book or anything. But I did meet people who were in the book. I stayed for a while with the Deweese family, the same family who had hosted Persig in the Sutherlands back in 1968. They live in Bozeman, Montana. And I only stayed the one night, but we had a fascinating conversation around the dinner table, which is a part of my book. But somebody asked me the other day, who was the most inspiring person that I met on the whole journey?
Mm.
And in fact, I had to think for a moment about it, but it would have to come down to being the motorcycle mechanic who Persig met only briefly. He sold him some rubber foot pegs, I think it was.
This is Bill, if I recall correctly.
Bill, that's mm-hmm. right. He lives in Miles City, Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill, I had no reason to phone him up. I didn't even know if he was still alive or anything. I didn't know how to reach him, but I just bumped into somebody on the street in Miles City who came up to me because I was riding a motorcycle. They'd never spoken to me if I'd been in my car. And we got talking, and it turned out that, yes, Bill was very much alive. And I went to go and see Bill with no great expectations. I had no reason to know what I was going to get into.
Mm.
And it turns out that Bill was a hardworking guy who ended up buying and building an airport. And the trouble with Bill is that for the last, I guess it's nearly a decade now, he's been battling with Parkinson's disease, which has been taking away a lot of his mobility. But he refuses to allow that to get him down. And he finds a way to triumph over adversity, whatever is thrown at him. In fact, on the day that I arrived, he just received the license plate for his trike. He couldn't ride a motorbike any longer because of his inability to balance. But he had been given a trike by his son-in-law, a three-wheeler, and it was finally allowed to be made road legal. And I bolted on the license plate for him, and he allowed me to take it for a ride up and down the runway, if you can believe it, of his home. And that was the time when I realized that, you know what, if you just come into life with the right attitude, you really can make your way over anything you choose.
Mm. The slightest intersection with Zen and the art of motorcycle maintenance, but finding that reconciling stance in his own way. Let's take a call from McCormick, South Carolina. Lucia, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello.
Hi, yes, you're on with us.
Well, I think I read the book first in 1974. That seems about right.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a young woman and a new professor of comparative literature in a Midwestern university, and it was a life-confirming experience for me. It helped me integrate so many aspects as a young woman, then I was trying to put together a very rational aspect of myself that the other half of me, which was quite creative and poetic, distrusted. And I think that was, you know, squarely one of the huge cultural schisms or schisms that we were going through at that time. And then I taught the book later as a professor, and began to invent courses, actually, that would enable me to teach the book, courses in literature as problem analysis and courses that tried to put philosophy and systems analysis and the cognitive into the more emotive aspects.
Did your students like it, Lucia? Did your students like it, or did they have the sort of...
They loved it. They loved it. The courses that were most successful in doing this were, of course, honors courses, rather interdisciplinary honors courses, which enabled me, too, to put these two parts of myself together. I was always the kind of person who was a double major in English and math and wanted to be a physicist but was a woman and so settled for comparative literature.
Well,
I was going through all of these things right along with my students, and this was through the early 80s, but they loved it. They loved it. My students who just really responded to this were the nerdy science majors. I recognized them from high school, you know. They would come in, and they were used to writing one paragraph and saying exactly the answer, period. But they were supposed to write a 3 or 4 page essay. So they expanded and began to use metaphor, because I used a lot of teaching about metaphoring, cognitive metaphor.
And you got them on the back of the bicycle, the motorbike, and we can imagine how they might have taken off with it. Lucia, our time grows short here. Mark, I wanted to ask you about Robert Persig's own life and what appeared to get reconciled and what didn't. He had his sort of alter ego in this book. He had his son behind him. His son tragically murdered outside a Zen center, as I recall, in San Francisco before he got out of his early 20s. Did Robert Persig, in the remainder of his life, appear to sort of get over the humps that he was struggling over before and during the book?
Well, Robert Persig had many challenges in his life. And as the fellow in the Wall Street Journal said this week, writing about my own book, he summed it up as, "This is a reminder of how much pain it can take to make so many people feel better." This is the irony that Bob Persig's life was in many ways a tragic life through the writing of this book. The inner peace that he was advocating was certainly not explicit in his own life. However, I feel very comfortable with being able to tell this story because it has ultimately ended in resolution. Robert Persig is now a very happy man, or I believe he is anyway. He's happily married. He's found the life that he wants to live. He's very content. His former wife is very content, and so is Ted, his surviving son. Mm-hmm. They've come through the fire, as it were, and it was a fire of madness and of drugs and all kinds of problems of the time. But they came through all of that to find their own resolution, and I had no idea it was such a fascinating story when I embarked on this, and I think that it is a lesson for us now.
Let's get one last call, Michael in Newtown, Connecticut. Michael, our time is short, but please join us.
Hi. I'm a psychologist, and I've been quoting one fact from that book for many years to my clients about the gumption trap of taking the bolts off the side cover of your motorcycle and then accidentally kicking it and having them all go down the storm drain and it just sucking away all your gumption. And I'm glad to hear about the continued interest in the book and the many important insights and messages from there.
Gumption, and when they're on the couch, that helps?
Yes. Yes, it just because that is an issue with people suffering from depression, that you know something hits them and just drains away their gumption.
Gumption in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and Lord knows everybody needs that to get through. James Landis, how do you look back on this now? I mean, in publishing? Do you call it a classic? Is one of the biggest, I don't know, books of philosophy, biggest sellers anyway of the 20th century?
Well, in a certain way, as a publishing thing, it's one of the happiest things to happen because this book is some 35 years old now, and people are still reading it, and it's a serious book and an enlightening book, and I think we don't have that many of those. So I called it a classic when I was trying to sell people on it, but it's not a word that I use normally for books, but I think this one has proved itself, and it doesn't need someone like a publishing person like me to call it that. I think that it's attained that on its own.
Well, we'll go out with one more bit from Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, Robert Persig writing, "So the thing to do when working on a motorcycle, as in any other task, is to cultivate the peace of mind which does not separate oneself from one's surroundings. When that is done successfully, then everything else follows naturally." And it has for that book. Mark Richardson's new book is Zen and Now on the Trail of Robert Persig and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Mark, thanks for taking the trip. Thanks for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Ron DeSanto, also in Denver, and James Landis, thanks to each of you and listeners as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.